Move to the next case today, which is Cruz versus NCS Healthcare.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ronald Lee Osman, on behalf of the United States Government and the State of Illinois, ex rel. Denise Cruz, with the Court's permission. I will not spend a lot of time today going through the facts, as they're set out very well in both of the briefs, but I do want to make some comments on the facts in this case. First, there is no doubt from the record that the defendants in this case recycled drugs that were received from nursing homes where Medicaid patients were present, and that during the recycling process, no record of the lot numbers or expiration dates of the drugs were kept. There's no doubt that there was not an inventory kept of recycled drugs, and the defendants did not in any manner track the recycled drugs. There's also no doubt that the recycled drugs were placed into an automated prescription filling machine called a Baxter machine, and that they were placed in that Baxter machine without logging into the recycled drugs in any manner.
And you're right, there are a lot of facts that aren't in dispute that show that there was a general fraudulent scheme, but what's your best authority for the argument that the evidence of a general fraud scheme is sufficient proof under FCA?
I'm not alleging, Your Honor, that a general fraud scheme is sufficient proof under the False Claims Act. What we are alleging and claiming is that due to the provider agreement wherein the provider, the defendants, agreed to comply with in paragraph 4 of that agreement with on an ongoing basis all federal laws and state laws regarding the dispensing of the drugs.
Well, what is your one particular false claim?
Well, Your Honor, there is one particular...
Go ahead.
Yes, the particular false claim is voucher number... there is a particular voucher number that Newt Connell...
Yeah, there's one that you identify. I understand that. How did that false certification cause the payment of federal funds?
The false certification?
Of that one claim.
Well, the false certification caused the payment of the federal funds. First off, Medicaid is 50% funded by Medicare, as Your Honor knows. And secondly, but for the false certification, the funds would not have been paid. That's the second prong of the test that has been set out and the Seventh Circuit has followed religiously, is that just a violation, any violation of a regulation or a rule will not automatically result in a false claim action. The second step to that is that it must have been a component part and that, in my vernacular, but for or had the government have known of the failure to comply with the regulation, would it have paid the claim? And in this instance, this is a pay-and-chase system, much as the same as the Fifth Circuit in the HCA case, which was based upon cost reporting. That's a pay-and-chase system, and that was the Seminole case that began this anti-kickback case. In this particular case, it's a pay-and-chase system wherein Medicaid payments are paid on a routine basis. Then if Medicaid becomes aware of problems, they recoup the money. The affidavit of the bureau chief that's in the record of Steve Bradley, I believe, indicates that had they have known, first off, we set out a predicate, if these are the facts, which the facts have been proven otherwise, had they have known, they would have recouped the money. That's what the False Claim Act is predicated on, Your Honor. as is indicated, it is undisputed that the defendant submitted and were paid claims based upon the agreement of participation, which is Exhibit 146. And the participation agrees that in part provides that on a continuing basis to comply with federal standards specified in Title 19 of the Social Security Act and also with all applicable federal and state laws and regulations. based upon participation agreement, this is a false certification case. By certifying that it would on a continuing basis comply with all applicable federal and state laws and representing in the failure to comply with 21 U.S.C. 331K, 410 ILCS 620.15 and 620.20, and 21 CFR section 212.204, the defendant Family Care filed numerous false claims with Medicaid. In fact, all the claims filed by defendant during the recycling effort were false due to the failure of defendant to comply with all rules, regulations, and applicable laws. This case is before your honors because District Court Judge Murphy dismissed the case on a motion for summary judgment by defendants, and in a three-page memorandum and letter, he stated in part that the problem for Relator is that she cannot show a particular false claim. He then cited cases from the 3rd, 9th, and 11th circuits stating that this very argument was rejected in those circuits.
Let me ask you this. There's a requirement that when you're bringing a false claims case that you're presenting sort of new bombshell information that was not available to anybody else, and you're in effect almost a whistleblower or something of that nature. And here there was a lengthy government investigation and guilty pleas and restitution orders and that sort of thing. So why wasn't all of this the kind of public, the big picture here, the kind of public information that would preclude a False Claims Act case?
Because in this case, Your Honor, Denise Cruz was an original source and cooperated and worked intimately with the, and this is not in this particular record, this was briefed below on some motions to that effect. She wore, she did an overhear for the government, so she was an original source and qualified to bring the False Claims Act.
Even though that the False Claims Act case is brought after a lengthy government investigation?
Well, Your Honor, the False Claims Act was brought, the government investigation was ongoing.
Mm-hmm. But I thought she filed her initial complaint 1 year after the task force raided the pharmacy.
That's correct, Your Honor. And it was raided on the basis of an overhear, and in the affidavit for the search warrant, it was raided on the basis of an overhear that my client did.
Well, when the affidavit was issued, there was it was issued in December of 2003, and IDPA had known about the pharmacy for 4 years, right?
Well, they had known about the pharmacy. They had not known of what was going on, Your Honor. I mean, they did an annual inspection, but they didn't know that the drugs were being recycled in the manner that they were. There is not an issue before this court, or was the issue raised in the district court, that, of whether or not Denise Cruz is an original source. She is an original source. I'm speaking outside the record because Your Honor's asked me that. But she is, she cooperated. She's an original source. It was filed in a timely manner in accordance with
false
claimant.
So you're saying that the Heron Pharmacy's practices were not known to the government as of October of 99?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But they were known of the time that this False Claims Act case was filed.
No, absolutely, Your Honor. But that's not the test under the False Claims Act. I mean, 90% of the False Claims Acts are sometimes there's investigations parallel going on. Sometimes the government doesn't even know about the False Claims Act being. It's not the test under the False Claims
Act. Well, the government always knows about a False Claims Act case because they're given a first opportunity to take over the case. And here the government... by your presence, the government has declined to pursue a False Claims Act case.
No, Your Honor, that's not correct. The government initially declined intervention. Then they came back in and intervened in the case, and they've elected to let me do the appeal. The government is still in this case. They originally declined, and then they came back into the case.
So I don't understand why your client's wearing the wire and all this other information you're telling us is not part of the record.
It was never an issue at the lower court, Your Honor.
And the argument was never made before the lower court.
That's
with
correct.
Respect to the action that she filed, the False Claims Act action, setting out what her participation was?
No, that was never raised, Your Honor. Because she is...
And you never argued that?
No, Your Honor, but it's because she is so obviously... And the reason it wasn't raised is because she is so obviously an original source and qualified to file.
Well, it may be obvious to you, but it's certainly not obvious to us because there's nothing in the record on that. I'm saying in terms of making your argument, given that there was a motion pending in the district court, I mean, this argument you're making about when she came forward, the fact that she wore a wire, that was not an argument that you utilized in arguing against the government's motion.
Against the government's motion? I didn't oppose the government at anything, Your Honor.
Okay.
The cases that Judge Murphy relied upon in the three districts are very distinguishable. In the Ninth Circuit, Aplatani case, there were no claims form present in that case. There was no corroborating testimony and no payment vouchers. In this instance, we have a payment voucher, we have corroborating testimony. In the 11th Circuit, the Clausen case, complaint was dismissed on a 9B motion for lack of particularity. In this case, we survived two 9B motions. And since the Clausen case, the 11th Circuit has had the opportunity to address the case that is more on point, and that is McNutt versus Haleyville Medical Supply, 423 Fed 3rd, 1256. In the McNutt case, a case similar to this, there was a provider agreement involved, agreed to comply with all laws. It was an anti-kickback case.
No, I just wanted to clarify, this was a motion for summary judgment the district court ruled on, and there's no mention in here about her role.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, and there's nothing in here. It's just a short 3-page order.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So
there was never an issue.
That argument was not made, I assume, before the district court for purposes of summary judgment.
That's correct, Your Honor. I was responding to His Honor's questions, and I specified it was outside the record. The court in that case concluded that because the government had alleged that the Burlington submitted claims for payment knowing that the government did not know because of their violation of the violation of the anti-kickback statute that those were false claims. That is a more on-point case out of the 11th Circuit. The Quinn case that is the closest to this case on the facts involves recycling of drugs. It involves Medicaid payment, but the only evidence adduced at the record at that time is that 60% of the prescriptions were paid by Medicaid. There was no evidence of returns, how many returns. There was no other evidence of that. In this case, we know from the evidence that 60% of the nursing home prescriptions were paid by Medicaid. We know that there was returns of 10 to 20%, depending upon the testimony, that came from those nursing homes. We know that 100% of those returns went into the Baxter machine and were not logged in any manner. We know then that the Baxter machine was used exclusively to fill nursing home prescriptions. So we have much more evidence than the Quinn case, and we also know that 10 to 20% of those were returned. So when you put all of those facts together, you can come up with a formula to show, and this should be a matter to the jury, that 10 to 20%, depending upon which witness they believe, of the drugs were recycled from the nursing homes. 100% of those recycled drugs went through the Baxter machine, and 100% of the Baxter machines, with a very small window of a few that went to a prison, went to the nursing homes. That is substantially different than the Quinn case.
You're into your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Silver?
May it please the court. I would like to address the original source issue that the court raised. The issue was raised below. We raised it on summary judgment, saying that Denise Cruz was not the original source and should not have been the relator in this case. What happened was the authorities approached several of the employees. I really don't know how many, but I do know that Denise Cruz was not the first employee that was approached by the authorities in this case. This was a small town, and also, unfortunately, what went on at the Heron Pharmacy was pretty well known. And also, one employee, at least, was married to a state trooper, so there was that connection. Deborah Connell was extremely disliked among the employees, so there were a lot of things going on, and the authorities knew something was happening, and they interviewed the employees and asked what was going on. It was not the other way around.
And that was in your motion?
That was in my motion.
That factual scenario
correct.
You just outlined for us.
Relator opposed the motion, mm-hmm. saying that Cruz was the original source, and contrasted the information that Cruz provided with that other employees provided. That, frankly, raised a factual issue, so I did not pursue it and didn't raise it on appeal. And it was not presented to the district.
Those
would
be in the pleadings below, though, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Mm-hmm. If you will look in the summary judgment papers, it is in a defendant's motion for summary judgment, or the NCS defendant's motions for summary judgment. On the issues that were briefed before this court, Relator argued below that in pleading guilty to the criminal charges, defendants admitted, as Mr. Osmond stated a while ago, to failing to maintaining records of lot numbers and expiration dates. But from this, Relator asserted that this failure rendered every claim a false claim. Now, the district court correctly held under the Third Circuit's decision in Quinn and the 11th Circuit's decision in Clawson that because the relator had not established that any medications without lot numbers and expiration dates were actually sold to Medicaid, that no false claims were established. This issue and the applicability of Quinn and Clawson are fully addressed in our brief, unless the court wants to engage on it, I prefer not to belabor that here, but rather I would like to go on to the voucher 630-6580, which I will refer to as the voucher.
Well, let me just get back to this other question.
Sure.
Just for a minute. What if the defendant's scheme was such that it was impossible to identify one particular claim as fraudulent? Would a plaintiff be precluded from recovery in that kind of situation?
If the plaintiff relator, who was an insider, could not identify...
It was an impossibility.
Nobody could do it.
Mm-hmm.
Quinn and Clawson appear to say so. I don't think that's the fact in this case. The relator was a pharmacist, one of the pharmacists who was employed at the Heron Pharmacy. Part of her job was to see what pharmaceuticals went out to the nursing homes. It was part of her responsibilities, and it would have been possible for her to have seen which strips went to which nursing homes and which went to which patients who were Medicaid beneficiaries. But the reason, and I'm not evading your question, but I think the reason I want to get on to the voucher and to the certification issue is that's kind of an easier one for the court to decide, and you don't have to reach that issue. if the court doesn't want to. The voucher here, there is no nexus between lot numbers and expiration dates and this voucher. And if I could briefly walk the court through the criminal information and the stipulation of facts in connection with the guilty plea, that becomes obvious. The voucher is part of count one of the criminal charges against Newt Connell. That count involves the storage and handling of controlled substances. Count two, which involves maintaining records of lot numbers and expiration dates, makes absolutely no reference to that voucher or any other voucher. In the criminal information charging Mr. Connell, which is reproduced in Plaintiff's Exhibit at page 116, count one is for falsifying a record on November 14, 1996, by failing to disclose, in connection with the voucher, that the pharmacy, quote, did not comply with federal regulations regarding the storage and handling of controlled substances. And the charge was of a violation of 18 U.S.C. sections 1001 and 1002 for making a false statement to the government. Count two is for the repackaging and recycling of drugs without regard to lot number or expiration dates in violation of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And count two, as I said, makes no reference to any voucher. Now, the stipulation of facts in connection with the guilty plea, which begins on page 118 of plaintiff's exhibits, actually page 119 is where the operative language is. The second full paragraph on page 119 appears to correspond to count one. And in it, Mr. Connell admits to making a false statement on a billing certification regarding the storage and handling of controlled substances. The next paragraph appears to correspond only to count two and refers to a failure to maintain records regarding lot numbers and expiration dates, but does not tie this to any billing certification or voucher. So the voucher is tied only to the false statement regarding controlled substances in count one. The storage and handling of controlled substances was never raised as an issue in this case, and the voucher was never tied to the failure to maintain records regarding lot numbers and expiration dates. So that voucher cannot support any of the false claims allegations that have been raised in this case. There is still no claim in which drugs with faulty lot numbers and expiration dates have been sold to Medicaid that has been identified in this case. To the extent there was a false certification in connection with the voucher, that raises a certification issue, but any certification that there may have been in connection with the voucher was not made part of this record because that certification was not raised below. It appears that this was a certification to comply with all applicable laws and regulations, but we're just guessing because that certification is not part of the record in this case. It was that, along with other things, was not raised below. There was a certification in connection with the provider agreement. And the provider agreement required NCS to, among other things, comply with all applicable laws and regulations. It also states that the knowing or willful falsification or withholding of information may be cause for termination of the agreement. As this court has recently ruled in the Gross case, where a False Claims Act violation is based upon a false certification of regulatory compliance, that certification must be a condition of government payment to be actionable. There is no evidence, aside from that one affidavit, that that certification is a condition for payment. And that affidavit, as was stated earlier, was executed in 2003 and said that if Illinois Medicaid had known what the pharmacy had done, it would have taken steps to recoup the Medicaid payments. Illinois Medicaid knew. The raid on the pharmacy was in January 1998, and it was spearheaded in part by the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit of the Illinois State Police. Mr. Connell entered his guilty plea in 2000. It's a fair statement that Illinois Medicaid knew exactly what went on at that pharmacy. Neither Mr. Connell nor NCS was ever charged with fraud, was ever charged with taking Medicaid and payments under false pretenses. Illinois has never sought to recoup any money from NCS for Medicaid money wrongfully paid, has never sought to withhold money going forward from NCS.
And what was the $200,000 in restitution supposed to represent?
Since I was not part of those plea negotiations, I don't know, but it was restitution in connection with the guilty plea for violation of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act.
Well, it wasn't a fine. It was restitution.
Correct.
So restitution is viewed as making whole somebody who had suffered a loss. So what does it cover?
I would like to say it's a court in satisfaction. I'm not sure you can read that much into it, but it was $100,000 went to Illinois Medicaid in connection with the corporation's guilty plea for improper record keeping in connection with lot numbers and expiration.
Well, that sounds like a fine if you're being penalized for improper record keeping. Restitution is
It was labeled restitution. In connection with a plea of guilty. So it's restitution in connection with a criminal prosecution.
Mm-hmm. What was the motivation for the conduct in this case? That is, the Baxter machine and all this.
Well, the Baxter machine.
I just want to focus on that. What was the motive? What caused this person to do the things that they were doing?
Honestly, I think things just got ahead of them and got out of control. Some of it was just plain sloppy work habits.
I guess was there a money motive? Right.
Not that I'm aware of. There, some people did testify that that they tried to make the top sellers, the ones that they recycled and that sort of thing. But I think most of the motive was simply. Things got ahead of them. They were trying to keep up with demand, keep up with the prescriptions, and there were extra pills that appeared from either overfills or misfills, and they didn't know what to do with them. They did not have a procedure in place. Frankly, there was no dispute that it was one of the most disorganized places you could imagine. And such was the disorganization, and I'm not sure this is in the record or not in the record, but attempts were made to dispose of some of the accumulation, and they couldn't even do that properly. It was just too much, and it was commingled.
Bags in the basement?
Yes. So it was not greed or excess in profit. It was just in total disorganization. And So whatever else may have happened there as a result of this disorganization and just bad business habits, there were no false claims submitted, and the False Claims Act should not be distorted just to fit the facts of this case.
Thank you, Mr. Silver. How much time? You have a minute and a half.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very quickly on the last one, if you refer to Exhibit 150, defendant Ernie LaPointe admitted that the defendant knew and directed that the most expensive drugs be recycled in an effort to increase revenues of the pharmacy. There was a profit motive.
Yeah. In the plea agreement I'm looking, it says there was some loss. The amount was, anyway.
Okay. Secondly, and I want to be sure that we're clear here, the government is still in this case. The issue of original source was briefed in the motion, but that would be a case that if this court determined would have to be a factual finding to go back to the district court. Secondly, and lastly, the standard for applying a criminal case against a civil case is not, is each ever is it exactly the same? That standard is set out in many cases in the Seventh Circuit. That's in our reply brief, pages 10 to 12. But Section 31 of the False Claims Act, Section 3731D, specifically speaks to this when it says, notwithstanding any other provision of law, the federal rules of criminal procedure or the federal rules of evidence, a final judgment rendered in favor of the United States in any criminal proceeding charging fraud or false statements, whether upon a verdict offered after trial or upon a plea of nolo contendere, shall stop the defendant from denying the essential elements of the offense in an action in which involves the same transaction as in the criminal proceeding which is brought under subsection A or B of section 3730. When read as a whole, all the criminal plea agreements provide exactly that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.